Well, as Ian was saying off the top, this congregation, all of you, were very generous this past year in making a contribution, a donation to the ministry, the men's ministry Manifest that I started back in July of 2015, and for that I am very grateful, really, really, truly so. It's been a very interesting year and almost a half since this started, and I could tell you more about that, but I'm not going to talk about that today because this is a time for preaching the gospel, not reporting out on Manifest. But I actually just this week and have sent it to a couple of people who are connected to Kathy, who I think is away right now. And I can't remember who the other person I sent it to it was, honestly. Oh, it was Susan Johnson, a donor newsletter that I created that talks a bit about some of the things that Manifest has been doing over its first year and a bit. And so they would be able to make that available, I'm sure, to anybody who would be interested in knowing. And of course, you can ask me questions as well if you want after the service. I'll be around. The only other plug I will make for Manifest right now is to say that the other thing that's out in the entryway there on one of those tables is a sign-up sheet. And if you would like to be on the mailing list for Manifest activities, anything that's coming up, retreats, those kinds of things, either because you're a man and you might be interested in participating or at least knowing they're going on, or perhaps you're a woman who knows a man who you might want to let know about that kind of thing. You're welcome to put your name and email address down there, and I will add you to the mailing list. But in the days we're in around privacy and all the rest of that, I'm not going to email anybody who doesn't say yes, please email me, right? So anyway, we have this this story before us that, I'm sorry, the gentleman who read. What's your name, sir?
Michael.
The story that Michael read for us. A very fine preacher and teacher of preaching named David Lowes has written that the question at the heart of this passage might be, can Jesus learn? Does Jesus, in fact, learn from the Syrophoenician woman or not? What I want to do is to kind of step back and have us look at the broader context in which this story would have been heard. Because remember that when the Gospels were written, they were written to be read or spoken aloud and in their entirety. What we usually do on a Sunday, well, what we always do on a Sunday, is we pull out a few verses, right, and we read those few verses. But what, and that's fine, except what can happen is that we can miss the context in which those verses occur. And there may be a broader theme, there might be a narrative arc that has something to say to us that we might miss just by listening to the one story. And I want to suggest that I think that might be the case in this story. So we heard a few verses from Matthew 15. If you went back to Matthew 14, not long before the story that Mike just read for us today, we find Jesus, who has spent the day healing people, and he gathers them together, and he feeds them. You know the story, right? There are thousands of them. And he gathers them, and they sit down on the hillside, and he feeds them. And there's very little food to begin with, but somehow everyone has enough. And the text tells us that when they cleaned up the leftovers, there were, do you remember how much was left over? Anybody? Bev? Yes, 12. There were 12 baskets full left over. what the text doesn't make explicit, but what some read into it, is that the 12 baskets stand for the 12 ancient tribes of Israel, right? Which no longer exist in Jesus' day. But so that there's the message in there that Jesus has come to heal and to feed the whole people of Israel. Now, in the first few verses of chapter 15, right after the story of the feeding of the 5,000, as it's called, there's a debate between Jesus and the religious leaders concerning Jewish dietary laws, which were very important. That was really one of the main ways that Jews differentiated themselves from Gentiles, from non-Jews, is by the fact that they only ate certain things and non-Jews ate other things that they didn't eat. And Jesus says in these verses that it's not what goes into the mouth that defiles, but what comes out of the mouth. Do you remember that line? Yeah. So in a sense, Jesus is saying the dietary laws are not what matters here. Or at least they don't matter as much as what we do and what we say. So in a sense, by calling these laws into question, the dietary laws into question, Jesus, it could be seen as calling into question the separation between Jews and Gentiles, between Jews and non-Jews. And immediately after that story, we have this story about Jesus then going off up northwest to the coast, to the region of Tyre and Sidon, which is Gentile territory. He's now left the land of the Jewish people, and he has this encounter with this woman. So there's two common interpretations of this story, coming back to David Lowe's, who I mentioned at the beginning. The first is that Jesus was just testing the woman all along and didn't really mean what he was saying. He just wanted to see what kind of a reaction he'd get out of her, right? When he said about the whole thing about the dogs and everything. The second interpretation is that Jesus' own sense of God's kingdom is challenged by this woman, is stretched by her, and is enhanced by this encounter with this fierce Canaanite Gentile woman. If we were to keep reading the text beyond where it ended today, when this story ends, the next story has Jesus back in the Galilee. And it's a familiar sounding story because he's been teaching and healing people all day, and it's the end of the day, and they're tired, and he gathers them all together and sits them down, and he says, bring out what you've got. And is this sounding like a familiar story? It's a difference. It's back in 14, and then it's again here. And then, so they eat, and this time, how much is left over at the end? Do you remember this one? This is the feeding of the 4,000. The last one is often called the feeding of the 5,000. This is the feeding of the 4,000. Remember how much was left over? Shall I just put you out of your misery? Okay. 7 baskets. 7. Why 7? Excellent question. Well, one of the possibilities, why 7, is that in that day and age, There was an idea of the 7 nations of the earth, the 7 peoples of the earth. So if the first story, where there is enough for everyone and there are 12 baskets left over that Jesus has come to feed and nourish and heal all the people of Israel, this story seems to be about Jesus coming to feed and nourish and heal everybody, the whole world. And just to make the point, the location of the second story, at least this is kind of the tradition of it, happens, it's still in the Galilee, on the north side of the Sea of Galilee, but the first story happens on the west side of the Jordan River in Galilee proper, and the second story happens on the east side of the Jordan River in Gentile territory. The second story is all those people there are non-Jews. All those people are you and me. So, do you see the possibility of a narrative arc through this part of Matthew's gospel, where Jesus begins focused on a mission to the children of Israel? And then he argues with the religious leaders for the inclusion of the Gentiles as God's people when he says what he says about the Jewish dietary laws. But then when actually confronted with a real live Gentile in his face, he says, "Get out of here. I'm here for the Jewish people." And when she calls him on it, have you noticed how sometimes our, you know, we think one thing, but our hearts and our bodies have not quite caught up with our thoughts? You know, like, yeah, I intellectually I understand that, and yet in my practice and in my way of being with the world, I have a hard time living out what intellectually I believe. I wonder. Seeing anybody else, but I wonder if this isn't kind of what happens for Jesus, that when he's confronted with this woman, it's like, well, you know, here's what he's been saying, sort of theoretically in a debate with the religious leaders, and now here he is face to face with this person, and he has to use an expression from probably at least the 90s, walk the talk. Of the two traditional interpretations of this text, I much prefer the second one. I like the idea that it's possible that Jesus learns from the Canaanite woman that God's kingdom and his mission to enact that kingdom is bigger than he, Jesus, had initially imagined and more encompassing than he first dreamed. Jesus demonstrates his humanity when he puts the Canaanite woman in one box and himself in another. The culture determined one identity for the Canaanite woman and another for Jesus, and Jesus accepts these externally imposed identities, and the Canaanite woman does not. And as humans, we have a tendency to do this, don't we? To categorize most things, including people. I'm a Gen Xer, which means I grew up on Sesame Street. I didn't literally grow up on Sesame Street. What I mean is I grew up watching Sesame Street. And do you remember in Sesame Street, there's the song, "One of These Things Is Not Like the Other," right? Like from our earliest days, we are taught, we are encouraged to differentiate things, to separate things and to put them into their own proper boxes. And that's necessary. I mean, if you're a hunter and a gatherer, you have to know which mushroom is going to kill you and which one is not. It's important to be able to differentiate. But at some point, this gets in our way. And what Jesus seems to be learning from the woman in this text is that this externally imposed sense that he and she don't go together has to change. A core belief underlying the work that we're doing with Manifest is that some of the dominant forms of masculinity, And here I'll invite you to think of kind of every masculine stereotype you can. Some of those are not serving us very well. That they're not serving men, they're not serving women, they're not serving the planet. And the statistics are pretty sobering. And you may have heard these kinds of things before. The statistics around things like suicide and violence and workplace deaths and violent crime and incarceration and life expectancy and all of this. The majority of these categories demonstrate that these dominant stereotypical models of masculinity, which is not to say that this is how all men operate, but I'm talking now about kind of how the culture imagines us to be, aren't really serving anybody very well. Boys tend, on average, again, to have lower marks in school. They're underrepresented in university admissions and in graduation. There's 100 ways to parse, dissect, and analyze such numbers, and I understand that any statistic can be used by any person to prove whatever point it is they want to make. I get that. But there seems to be a suggestion that both males and females are having to deal with the realities of the sort of stereotypical ways that masculinity is constructed in our culture. Now, there's a big debate as to where gender comes from. How much of it is biological and how much of it is socially constructed? And the truth is, it's probably some of both. But there's a piece of gender for all of us, male or female, and that's a spectrum, right? And wherever you are, probably the farther out we are on the male or female ends of the spectrum, perhaps the more likely we are to be entrapped in these models of how we're allowed to express our gender. But these are laid on us from the time that we are born. When boys tend to be treated in one way, and girls tend to be treated in another. I remember when our girls were babies and we would dress them in blue or brown or, I don't know, you know, some sort of not pink. And some people were really quite disturbed by that. Like that was a problem for them. And we have choices then, right? We have choices when we are constructing the gender of our children. So to tell a little boy who is crying that big boys don't cry is a choice that we make, not a choice that he made. And maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't be surprised at how many little boys are still told that. The same goes for little girls, right? Can you imagine a major entertainment corporation, global corporation, constructing a model of femininity where the main role model for little girls are princesses whose principal goal is in life is landing a prince? Can you imagine such a thing? We all have choices, each of us individually, that we make at some point about how we express our gender, whether it's male or female or somewhere in between. And so we can all ask ourselves, what does it mean for me to be a, however you describe yourself? How much is the way that I act out my gender based on social scripts that I feel pressured to live up to and to live out? And how much is a genuine expression of who I really and authentically am? The options for women to express their gender have grown and expanded tremendously in the last couple of generations. and the work is not done. There is still a glass ceiling. It is not a level playing field. But for any of you who remember what it was like even in the 60s, things are, for many women anyway, progressing in a good direction. That seems to be less true for a lot of men. Although the millennials now, the 20-somethings, they're, man, that's a different game with those, that generation. But for the rest of us, there's still a lot of guys who seem to be constrained into operating out of. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like, have you noticed this at all in either the women and the men that you know? And I know it's not universal, and it's stereotypical, but you know, stereotypes in some sense are based in some kind of glimmer, at least, of reality. So part of what we're doing at Manifest is we're creating opportunities for men to be open-hearted with each other, to get men talking with each other about real and significant things that are going on in our lives. Not sports, not politics, and not work, except in as much as work is kind of a major expression for a lot of men of who they are, right? It's where they find a lot of, where we find a lot of our identity. And there are some powerful conversations happening. And probably the biggest gift to me in this work is being able to witness the kinds of conversations that I see men having together. By gathering for conversations of the heart on subjects that matter to them, creating opportunities for community and places for healing. Part of what we're trying to do at Manifest, actually the main thing we're trying to do, is increasing men's sense of God's grace and love and justice for them and for all of God's creation, so that we may all, men and women, begin to let go of somebody else's story for our life and live instead into the fullness of God's story as it's being lived out and told in each and every one of us. During one gathering earlier this year with a group of men that I was meeting with every month, so we'd been developing some trust over the course of the year and some greater depth. And we talked about fear. That was the subject one night, fear. What is your deepest fear was one of the questions. What have you learned from your fear? How have you learned to dance with your fear? And have a group of men start talking about that with each other. And at the end of the meeting, as we were checking out, we were saying about how the evening had been for us, and there was some great energy around the room. And one of the men had never talked, two or three of the men had never talked about their fears with another man before, ever. And these are 60-somethings. And they were totally juiced at the experience, at what they had experienced that night. You know, they showed up, like they stepped up and they stepped into the any discomfort they might have had, and they talked about it. So I wonder, for those of you who are women, whether there are dominant, culturally acceptable expressions of femininity that you have taken on. Not because they really reflect who you are, but because you somehow felt or feel that that's just kind of what you had to do, and maybe you did. And for the men here today, perhaps it's not emotional literacy. Perhaps it's not the capacity to talk about your fears. Maybe you got that down. But maybe there's something else that has had or has now your number, as it were. Something else, some other mask that you have been wearing that has obscured the real and authentic you. All of us might ask, what are the things we know and ignore anyway? What are the things we know in our heart, in our heads, and yet have such a hard time living out in our actual lives? What's the cost that we have paid, all of us now, for pretending to be someone or something we were not? If Jesus learns in this story that God's kingdom and his own vocation were bigger than what he'd first thought, what might we learn about how our deepest, most authentic selves are bigger and more nuanced than the cultural scripts that give us messages about how we are and are not to behave? So as you leave here for the places you will find yourselves in the coming week, may you, like Jesus, have your horizons broadened as you experience something of the more that God wants to give you. May you, like the Canaanite woman, learn once again to let go of someone else's story of your life in order that you might live more fully into the fullness of God's story for you. And may all of us be transformed and renewed by the power of the Holy Spirit working within us, doing infinitely far, far more than anything any of us could ever ask or imagine, so that God's beauty might shine forth through our beauty and the whole creation might be blessed. Amen.